This ASAP podcast is brought to you by Spec Athletic, the synthetic sports surfacing company, building facilities that athletes can work out on, train on, and compete on. Spec Athletic, the flooring professionals with Regapol America technology. Check them out at specathletic.com. This is Ed Sicali with Athletic Strength and Power Podcasts. Today in Raleigh, North Carolina, at the North Carolina State University, home of the Wolfpack, with Nate Brookerson. I'm also with Craig Turner, and they're joining us for our podcast here from Raleigh. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be on.
First of all, Nate, you're a Washington guy, we notice, on all of the things, and you're from Washington. What got you way out here to Raleigh, North Carolina?
I'll give the succinct story behind this one. So, you know, in getting into this industry, you wanted to pursue what you consider the best jobs, best opportunities. Sometimes you got a little away from, you know, whether you're in the vicinity of family or not. So when I got done playing arena football and working out in Washington, I was looking into grad school and said I needed to go to the place that had the best athletes possible in order to get, a master's degree. So I looked in SEC and Big 12, ended up at University of Georgia. So it took my wife and I across the country, was able to get back after a year to go back to Eastern Washington, so back home in the state, worked there for close to 6 years, and then decided I needed to make the switch back to Olympic sports, and there just wasn't as many opportunities in the state of Washington to work in collegiate strength conditioning. So that took me to University of Memphis, which was really the reason I was able to get this job, was able to be a director of Olympic sports at Memphis for 2 years. And when I talked to Bob Alejo, who was here at the time, he was looking for somebody that had a very similar skill set to mine. And so now it's taken me, 3,000 miles away from Washington, but opportunity, I'm always following where the best opportunities are, and it just happened to take me to a state that's very similar to Washington, except just much more hot and humid.
Good stuff. When we're talking about Olympic sports here at North Carolina State, what are all those sports how does that all?
Yeah. So everything is classified really now at the collegiate level as Olympic sports if it's not football. So literally everything else is lumped into that, even if it's not actually they compete in it in the Olympics. So that would be something like baseball. So everything else is Olympic sports.
Our paths crossed a couple of years ago up at Adrian College. You were one of the speakers at a hammer strength clinic up there.
Yeah. So that was an opportunity. It's actually where I met Ted. And it was
And you spoke on, what were some of the topics that you...
Yeah, so spoke on kind of the simplicity or the entry points into athlete monitoring. So, for coaches that were saying, this is what I'm doing from an implementation standpoint, but I want to see if I'm on the right path with what I need to do with my training. It was, how do you kind of glean information from your training process to determine if you're going the right direction in terms of what you're expecting to be able to accomplish? So it was simple things around differential RPE and vertical jump monitoring and getting into a little bit of, if you had the opportunity to be at a practice, some things that you could take and communicate back to a coaching staff.
RPE, can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of educate our listeners about that?
Yeah, so I'll start and I'll pass this one to Craig as well, because I think he'll add some definite depth in this one. So the way that I kind of entered into it was with just session RPE, which is just a rating of difficulty around how hard a session is. So basically it's an arbitrary unit value that you're looking at, how long the session was multiplied by how hard it was on a scale of, 0 to 10 or 0 to 100. I've used 0 to 10. And being able to take that and kind of make sense of the physiological demand behind an activity without having to say, break it down into all these different domains. What's kind of been looked at more recently with Matthew Weston and kind of his crew out of the UK is differential rating of perceived exertion, which is now, instead of just one arbitrary value, it would break it down into leg exertion, upper body exertion, breathlessness, and kind of technical tactical demand. Mm-hmm. So now you can kind of see where, again, some of that physiological mechanical stress is really coming from to be able to kind of differentiate a little bit more behind, the fatigue that's occurring with an athlete.
Yeah, so as Nate just said there, kind of RPE is a representation of the training loads, in particularly more of the internal response. Mm-hmm. So we have external measures, which can be like how many reps somebody does, how long they do it for, the distance they run. But the only internal representation that we have is from technology, so like heart rate monitors, stuff like that. So RPE being a free, available, subjective criteria that can be used with an athlete to understand their internal response to that exercise demand allows us to then break down the session a little bit more, understand how they respond, what intensity the session was at. And as Nate touched upon as well, with the different constructs, we kind of liken the athlete to the car. So we want to understand the engine, which would be like the heart, the cardiovascular system, but also the suspension as well. So the muscles, the legs. So being able to like understand the muscular load versus the breathlessness load, we can see if that session was more of a cardiovascular based type session or whether it was more mechanical impact. So it hit the suspension, so the muscular demand was higher.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff. And then running this whole Olympic sport program at North Carolina State, is there like a certain process that you go through to get certain coaches working with certain teams, or do you coordinate that through the head coach, or how do you kind of tie that all together?
Yeah, the goal of the department is to have more of a shared philosophy behind training rather than kind of have all these, you know, renegade style people in regards to like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. It's more so thinking about how do we have kind of a unified framework behind what we feel like are actionables or deliverables with our athletes. We want people that have a knowledge base behind the sport. It doesn't mean you have to have played it. It doesn't mean you have to be an expert in the sport initially. So really the entry point for a lot of our coaches is to kind of conduct a needs analysis, which is understanding more about the movement demands behind the sport, the energy system demands, different positional tactics, understanding what the objectives are of the coach to be able to kind of glean that information again to have a little bit more depth of understanding. But we're not trying to say, okay, just because you played college baseball, you're going to work with baseball. It's more so, again, can you take this framework? Can you apply it to any sport? And really the kind of the human piece is to be able to connect with a coach to determine, again, what is actually going to be able to work in that context, in that situation, rather than just saying like, This is what I do. This is all I'm capable of doing. It's more so being able to work, you know, cohesively within that unit.
Is there a challenge between when you're running a program like this? Is there a challenge between managing coaches and things like that and micromanaging?
Yeah, this is a massive challenge because the way that I look at this position, it just kind of zooms in and out, right? So you get kind of that 30,000 foot view where you're sitting in a sport administrator type of meeting where you're saying, okay, basically just talk about what is strength conditioning, what are their roles, what are you guys trying to accomplish, how do you fit within this department? But then going all the way down to, you know, within sports that I work with, I work directly with swim and women's basketball, have, you know, individual almost consults where I'm doing assessment or just examining that athlete at that, again, that kind of micro level. So being able to kind of, again, zoom in, zoom out, it's very challenging. So with this staff, you know, you want to hire good people. You want to hire people that are willing to be challenged and don't act like they have all the answers. Hopefully people that kind of have a low ego in regards to they have an understanding about the training process and they're wanting to get better, but at the same time, they're not acting like they have, again, every single answer. And you want to give them as much autonomy as possible. It doesn't mean there's not going to be times where you're going to try to step in and help upskill. But at the same time, the micromanaging piece, I've been in those situations before from kind of the reverse side. And it's very hard to really operate and grow when you feel like, okay, the person that's looking over my shoulder is dictating everything that I'm going to do or is not, you know, backing my play, so to speak, if I feel strongly or compelled to act in a certain way. Again, hopefully the conversation that you have or the understanding you have about, again, the framework that you're trying to deliver as a staff is going to help drive your decision process. And then ultimately that back end is your needs analysis to understand a little bit more about the nuance or the specificity of that sport instead of just saying, like, I got to reinvent it every single time I walk out here with this particular situation. There's at least enough kind of shared understanding within the staff that you have confidence that people are going to make the right decisions.
Let's flip back to Craig Turner. You know, you've just completed a book.
So that was in 2016, so PhD in the sleep of youth soccer players.
To put it in a nutshell, what were some of the things that really came out of your research?
The big headline is that athletes struggle to sleep. I think that's no shock. The whole general population, I think, struggles to sleep. Social demands, obviously with athletes, particularly collegiate athletes, they've got both social demands, their academic side, but also their training side. So there's three big rocks there that can really disrupt sleep. Some of my investigations were in more of like the elite level professional academy players. And we saw the same things there. Like they don't sleep very well. It's very disrupted. And we also started to relate that back to training. So when we went through our more high intensity training blocks, we saw a lot more sleep disturbances. So actually that kind of gives us a general sense of whether we can use sleep as a monitoring indicator to see how our athletes are actually responding to training. So as sleep started to get more and more disturbed, we started to then lower our volumes of training and make it a little less intense and see if like the sleep patterns return back to their normal levels, which in one of my studies they did. And then the other big important rock was obviously if people aren't sleeping well is how can we actually turn around and make that sleep better? So implementing what's called sleep hygiene strategies, which allows like the person to plan their bedtime routine, do specific stuff before bedtime to actually enhance sleep. So one of the things that I looked at was temperature and manipulating temperature, because our core temperature is very much related to a sleep state. So the higher the core temperature, the less likely you are to fall asleep. So one quick, easy way that we decided to lower the core temperature was by showering. So they took a 10-minute shower 20 minutes before bedtime, and that allows basically what's called vasodilation. So the blood kind of rises to the surface of the skin and it allows heat to go through the hands and the feet. And that allows the core to start slowly dropping in temperature, which promotes a sleepy state. So
colder shower, colder temperature, water,
a warmer shower, believe it or not. So the one thing you don't want to do is cool the skin. You want to warm it up.
Really?
So that allows the blood to rise to the surface. Whereas if you cool it down, the veins constrict. So actually the blood goes back towards the central organs because it's kind of a survival mode. So it heats up the organs that needs the most temperature. So we actually wanted the reverse effect. We want the hands and feet to warm up more than the internal organs. Mm-hmm. So that allows like the temperature to be released through there. And then that automatically starts to drop the core temperature. And we saw that then sleep latency, which is the technical term for how fast you fall asleep, we saw that reduce considerably in a lot of athletes who took a long time to fall asleep.
How about napping? A lot of players need naps and things like that, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll always promote naps with athletes. Some athletes struggle to nap. It depends if it fits in the schedule of their day. The kind of big key points with napping is you want to kind of keep it underneath 30 minutes.
How many? 30?
30 minutes, yeah. Okay. Or up to 90 minutes. And that's just basically based on the way sleep phases through the different cycles. So we have four key cycles of sleep. So the first two stages are light sleep. Then we transition into deep sleep, and then we go into what's called REM or dream sleep. Up until about that 30-minute mark, we're still in light sleep. So if we wake up from our nap from there, we'll wake up, we'll feel refreshed. If we go beyond that time and we wake up after 45 minutes, we're more likely to wake up in deep sleep, and that's where you wake up and you actually feel worse and more tired. And that's called sleep inertia. So that actually has the reverse effect, so you kind of feel worse off for it. And then the final stage is REM, which is kind of the closest to awakening. And that's when you normally experience your dreams. That's when you kind of sometimes wake up and remember your dreams, because that transition normally comes out of REM. So at the end of a 90-minute cycle, that's roughly where you're going to transition out of REM. So again, you'll wake up more likely in the light stage of sleep, so you'll feel more refreshed.
All right, back to Nate Brookerson. Coach, if you could tell us a little bit about some of the markers that you look at, you know, with the training that your teams are doing.
I guess kind of going back to that framework discussion earlier, this is the idea of you kind of have your big rocks. So, you know, from a testing standpoint, we're going to look at something that would be kind of in a bucket of alactic, and a bucket that's kind of in a repeatability or anaerobic bucket, and then something that would be more aerobic. Again, depending on the sport, that's really going to dictate what people are looking at within those kind of confines. But if I'm looking at, say, swimming, so for our alactic bucket, we'll look at some different jump variations. So we look at counter movement jumps. Basically, what we're looking at is flight time on jumps, just jump mats, but we're also looking at, every month we're looking at jumps off force plates. So we're looking at qualities of concentric impulse, eccentric braking force, RSI mod, so different characteristics of the jump, because as we start to look at the sport, it's something that will kind of dictate how they perform with like early and late stage block starts in relation to some of those characteristics. Their repeatability piece or their anaerobic bucket, we're not testing currently, but we're going to look at some power performance testing with particularly with the upper body. So one of the ones that we're going to include here coming up soon is just a repeat test with three pull-ups, and we're going to look at peak velocity off that and average velocity, and that's one that we're relating back to once they get above water, how they're actually performing. So once they've broken out and they get above the surface, I guess from kind of aerobic bucket, that's a sport that we wouldn't necessarily need to get into kind of like energy system demand, because there's not a lot of things that we can use as kind of a quote unquote surrogate to be able to look at, you know, what their aerobic levels are. They're getting a lot of that stuff from the sport. But if we flip that to with women's basketball, we'll look at repeat sprint ability. So they'll do six 30-meter sprints with 30 seconds of rest in between, and we're looking at basically just speed decrement over the course of that. And then we'll look at, from an aerobic bucket, we look at yo-yo IR1, which for them is, it's not like a pure aerobic activity, but it's more representative of kind of the aerobic demands that are going to be within their sport. So again, it really changes depending on the sports that you're working with. It's just, you know, what I expect from the staff is to have a thought process behind the whys of what you're testing, and then how it fits within, again, whether it's energy system demand or it's things that you feel like are contributing to the success of the sport. If you can have representation of that through the literature with the goals of ourselves being able to kind of build out some representation in our own kind of confines in regards to some of the testing that we'd like to do. You know, some of the stuff that Craig and I will be talking about moving forward is some of the isometric testing that we'd like to do with some of our sports, just as another means to look at force qualities. So with swim, we're looking at the ASH shoulder test. So it's a three position IYT, and we're looking at force characteristics off that. Craig's been looking at a 90-90 iso hamstring test with soccer players. Hmm. So again, it doesn't always have to be the most traditional test. You just have to have a thought process behind why you want to look at what you're looking at, and if there's representation in literature, so be it. If not, then hopefully, you know, that's an area that we're trying to build out on our end as well.
You mentioned force plates. What are some of the ways that you set that up and conduct those testings?
Yeah, so again, kind of going back to the various tests that you want to look at, the simple one that we can do with most sports is just a counter movement jump. It's not something that's so complex that, you know, athletes don't know how to do it, and it gives us a good, again, representation of the characteristics behind the jump rather than just examining jump height. You can look at concentric, eccentric, force and velocity characteristics within the jump. Mm-hmm. And then the isometric testing would be another area that we're trying to look at. So again, that kind of 90-90 hamstring, the three position shoulder test.
Touching on like the other kind of jumps that we also can do as well. So the other things that we look at are landing characteristics. So particularly with like some of our athletes that are starting their mid-stage rehab, so they're being transitioned back into the weight room, is looking at like the force characteristics, the force characteristics and asymmetry side to side. So the ability of the force plate allows us to look at both left and right leg. So when you've got, say, an injury that's occurred to the knee on the right side, we can start looking at the landing characteristics and seeing if more force is being generated and put through that knee, particularly in a landing, versus the opposite side. So then we can start working on some corrective strategies as well.
True sports scientists, you guys are really incorporating a lot of the science into this training. That's, you know, the last 5-10 years has really been on the upswing. The other thing I kind of wanted to touch on today before we leave is on nutrition and how nutrition is being changed here at North Carolina State with your programs and how that is being, you know, incorporated.
So we have two full-time nutritionists currently that are registered dietitians. We're going to be adding two additional RDs to our staff. So, you know, one of the things is just, it's the growing understanding of the impact of nutrition in performance. We're continuing to kind of have conversation around how we can nuance kind of specific demands per characteristics of an athlete or a sport. You know, the thing that's kind of happened with nutrition at the collegiate level is that there's so many things that's kind of put on their plate, no pun intended, in regards to what they, you know, their deliverables are. So they end up having elements of kind of having to cater, right? So they're ordering food, they're there for kind of delivery and kind of dissemination to the athletes, nutritional education. They're doing individual consults with athletes that are kind of like at-risk populations. So for us, it's being able to kind of streamline their process around, you know, how can we reach large groups of athletes? How can we deliver and disseminate consistent messages around, you know, the lack of knowledge or the understanding that an athlete has from a nutritional standpoint? And then, you know, the big piece is, as we're moving forward, is how to utilize social media to be able to help educate and again, get the athletes to understand a little bit more about, again, the nutrition process.
So you're using social media to shoot messages out to the athletes? And
yeah, I mean, that's been something that's been explored here. You know, they're on the platforms. It's just a matter of, you know, what type of messages that we're sharing with the athletes and being able to, again, it's the demand of their time. They're in high demand in regards to, okay, we need you here for X, Y, and Z. Again, the catering pieces and ordering and delivering of food and things like that. But mm-hmm. that ability to really connect with an athlete population, I think sometimes, you know, you only have so many hours in the day. So it's how do we have these kind of deliverables, these messages that, again, can really get to the athletes and help to influence and produce change in regards to their habits. But that being said, it's still a profession that we're just exploring, like what all they are able to do at a high level, and then how we can all kind of work together. Just, you know, the collaborative efforts, how they're upskilling our staff to be able to deliver a consistent message. I think that we've discussed a lot of that, is how can we be kind of the vessel of information, because, you know, we're around them every single day. You know, if you have 4 full-time nutritionists, we have 7 staff members on our end. Athletic training has 24 full-time ATCs. So how do we have these kind of consistent deliverable messages that we can take to the athletes, and so they're not overly spread out to have all these kind of individual or group consults?
So you guys are totally incorporating the whole scope of the athlete.
Yeah, I mean, as much as we can. Again, it's in every single area at the collegiate level. It's, you have 550 athletes. How do you make everything scalable? How do you do things at a high level and not just say, like, okay, I'm just going to be apathetic and saying, like, I can't do this at the level that I want, so I'm just not going to do it. And so a lot of that is just, how do we continue to lean on one another from a kind of a collaborative standpoint, just to again, help one another out, to be able to have the athlete at the center of the model and to make it about them.
And, Coach, there's a lot going on in here today as far as transitioning and moving around. You got a desk moving in and out of here. What's going on with this?
You know, one of the things that we've increased our sports psychology staff. So we kind of had a sports psychology wing. So we had one full time prior to this year. We've added 2 others in kind of a, I don't know if it's a full time role or if it's more of a kind of a part time going into that. So that's been kind of a dedicated wing for them. So there's 3 office spaces up there. They need individual meeting space, because really all their meetings are going to be consults. And so nutrition was kind of displaced. And my thing was, just the exposure to the athlete is a good thing. So them being around the training process as much as we could possibly keep them around it. And I've never been, you know, averse to having people in my quote-unquote space, so I've tried to keep them in this office as much as I could. Eventually, the idea was, we need to give them their own space so they can have the consults, they can have kind of their ability to kind of spread out in regards to nutrition supplementation type of stuff, so they're not just, like, you know, sitting at a desk in the middle of another office space. So we've kind of created another space for them within the weight room. So again, just that ability to have more exposure to the athlete, they're not kind of off in the corner of the building. Just being in the flow of what's happening on a day-to-day basis, I think, is important. So they're not feeling like, okay, the athlete has to come to me. It's now they get that general exposure. Just, I can walk out into a training session, I can catch an athlete walking in and walking out because I see them here, rather than, you know, you'd be surprised just saying, hey, you have to go 100 steps out of your way as an athlete. Mm-hmm. Like how difficult that is for some of our athletes to do. Like, I kind of have my path. This is what I do on a day-to-day basis. And, like, just going out of my way to go have a conversation, like, that's too much for me. Right. So just make it as simpler and as impactful as we can on the athletes. Just have them around as much as we can.
Nate Brookerson. He's the director of Olympic Sports Strength and Conditioning here at North Carolina State University. Nate, we really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to spend some time with us and conduct this podcast. And Craig Turner, also much appreciation for some of the explanation of some of the research you've been doing and everything. Guys, really extend a great thank you to both of you for spending some time and opening your doors here at North Carolina State University. We're here in Raleigh. Take care, guys.